Great, so we're going to get started here. I'm not used to this hall. This is a very nice, luxurious-looking, very fitting of you to inaugurate our session today. I'm very excited to have Juan Jose with us today. My name is Carl Meacham. I'm the director of the Americas program here at CSIS. We're inaugurating our use of this room, and I think, again, you're the right person to do that. So I welcome all of you to CSIS. Today's event, Elections in El Salvador, What's at Stake, addresses the upcoming February presidential election and challenges the next president will face. Before I turn it over to today's speakers, I think it's helpful to provide some background on where the election stands. The first round election is set for February 2nd. The contest is at this point a three-way race, representing the ruling party of the FMLN. Current President Funes is ineligible to run for re-election. So his current Vice President Salvador Sanchez Seren, I'm sorry. Running Sanchez Seren's VP candidate is Oscar Ortiz. So these two are not eligible. So the VP candidate is, is Oscar Ortiz. I think I'm messing this up pretty badly.
That's okay.
So we're going to be very clear here. So Sanchez Seren is running, and his VP is Oscar Ortiz, currently the popular mayor of Santa Tecla, who has helped boost the appeal of the ticket. Running on the Arena ticket is Norman Quijano, who is currently the mayor of San Salvador. And finally, there's also the candidacy of former President Antonio Saca. While Saca belonged to Arena during his presidency, he has split with the party and is running as a representative of the Unidad Coalition. Polls show a very close contest, with Sanchez Seren and Quijano in a near tie, and Saca running a distant second. Of course, a lot can change between now and February, but it looks like we can expect a March 9 runoff between FMLN and Arena. Whoever becomes president, they will likely have to confront several pressing issues at the start of their presidency. Corruption remains a leading concern within the country. Just to give one example, El Salvador, 83rd in Transparency International 2012 Government Corruption Index, it's a sharp drop from 51, where it stood in 2004. And there's growing unease with issues ranging from government transparency and independence of the judiciary. Another is the state of the economy. Another issue is the state of the economy. Economic growth remains anemic in El Salvador. In 2012, it stood at 1.9% and is expected to only reach 1.6% this year and next, according to the IMF. Bold measures will likely be needed to boost domestic growth. There will, of course, be other issues for the president to address, including security and relations with the United States. But I think that it will be helpful if we focus today's discussion on the elections in El Salvador and the current economic situation, which I think Juan Jose will elaborate on extensively. So to join us today, we have Juan Jose Dabub. He probably needs very little introduction to most folks who are here today. He currently is the chairman and CEO of the Dabub Partnership. Before that, he served as managing director of the World Bank from 2006 to 2010, and was the Minister of Finance in El Salvador from 2001 to 2004. I'll stop there in the interest of time. I think you have a more complete bio of Juan Jose, and it shows how impressive he is. A few housekeeping rules. When you have questions, first we're going to do the presentations. When you have questions, please identify yourself. If you're sitting around the table, we'll get a microphone to you so you can be heard by everybody else. A lot of the issues here will probably get folks' passions. What I would suggest is, yes, we do want to hear your views, but please try to keep them brief so we can get to as many people as we can during the course of today's session. So without further ado, I hand it off to you.
Thank you very much, Carl, and congratulations on the new building. Thank you for all of you for joining us this afternoon. A couple of things that I think Carl did not mention but that I like to emphasize is that I do not belong to any political party. I never did. I don't do now. And even though I was in government for 12 years, I worked for three different administrations, the Cristiani, the Calderon Sol, and the Flores administration. I never was in party politics. And so I'll try to give you some facts, but also my opinion in some of the areas that I think is important for this kind of audience to be informed. I like to start also by saying that in the past, I used to go to road shows promoting El Salvador in New York, in Singapore, in Asia, sometimes in the Middle East, because there was a very good story to tell, a very positive story to tell about El Salvador. And it's a little bit uncomfortable for me to come and tell you about a parenthesis or a bump that we are going through in my country. But I would like, hopefully towards the end, to persuade you that I tend to believe that this bump that we are going through, we're going to be able to superate it and come out of it as strong or stronger than once we were. The path to prosperity is not a straight line. And so we are, as I said, passing one of those periods of our history that is not the most benevolent one. El Salvador is in the final stretch of an election whose outcome will have substantial effects, not only in El Salvador, but in my view, in Central America, and certainly in the United States. It's kind of a test between a sustainable model and an unsustainable model that has proven to have failed in many parts of the world. So what is at stake? Stability, freedom, security. And these three have a direct relationship and an impact on economic growth and migration. I will give a one-minute history, or 1 minute and a half history of El Salvador. Then I'll talk briefly about Washington, and the majority of the presentation will be about the elections and what I think the future holds for my country. As many of you recall, and many of you actually live this, the last war of the Cold War was fought in El Salvador in the 70s and 80s. Today, Cuba, through Venezuela, is going against El Salvador again. What they were not able to accomplish with weapons, it is now being pursued by capturing and weakening institutions, by some political persecutions and populism. And this perverse combination can weaken almost any country, any economy, for as strong as this one might have been before their arrival. The history part is the following. During the years of the armed invasion, we lost about 5% of our people. They were killed. And about 22% of the Salvadorian population migrated primarily to the United States. So there is a US domestic policy issue there. Our credibility at that time was zero. We had no credibility in many parts of the world. However, El Salvador was able to go from hardship to investment grade in a relatively short period of time. Now, how did we do that? First and foremost, we stopped blaming others for problems that were ours. We actually, Salvadorians, took destiny into their own hands, and we decided not to let things be done by politicians or foreign interests, but actually get involved. That's one of the reasons many of us went back to El Salvador from, in my case, the United States. We opened our economy, we put the fiscal house in order, and strongly respect property rights. The results, and I'm going to refer to the results between 1989 and 2004, were very categoric, and these are facts. Poverty was cut by half. Access to health, education, and other public services increased significantly, in some cases, up to 90% coverage of telecommunications, electricity, and water. Inflation was reduced from 30% to 3%. Unemployment from close to 11 to less than 3%. And just to give you another simple example, a telephone call that used to call $2.50 to call that 22% of our population living here for 1 minute, $2.50, came down to about 6 or 7 cents. Now, this was all good news until we turned in the wrong direction and went from economic and political freedom to populism and the so-called socialism of the 21st century. So between 2004 and today, from being next to Chile and New Zealand in many indicators, to next to Zambia, Ghana, and Guyana. There is nothing wrong with Zambia, Ghana, and Guyana, except that they have never been next to Chile and New Zealand. Poverty has increased significantly, security has worsened, and as it was said earlier, corruption has increased, and I will add, gangs and drugs are kind of running the show. Let me briefly show you a few slides that tell you what the effects of these last measures have been. From a country that was growing at an average of 4%, we are now, this year, somewhere at the bottom, and the perspectives for next year do not get any better. From a country that between 1990 and 2004 was growing an average, you take the average, about 4%, to less than 2%. From a country that, as I said earlier, was very close in a couple of years, actually in the year 2001, we beat Chile in the index of economic freedom, to a country that is now below Vietnam and other countries and very close to the countries that I just mentioned a minute ago. All of these indicators, which are used by many respectable institutions, including the MCC that is present here, but also the World Bank and others, show that regrettably in the last few years, we have come down all of those numbers in red in economic indicators, in governance indicators, in corruption indicators, security indicators, in human development indicators, you name it. At the same time, and this is surprising, but the last four or five years, we have had the richest government in power. They have had the largest tax collection with an increment of about 11% per year, which puts us, GDP adjusted, at the top four. So we have a tax base that is comparable to countries that are doing significantly better than we currently are. Now, what has happened with that money? Well, as the lines show, expenditures in blue and, expenditures in blue and tax revenues in red, there is a gap of close to $800 million. That for an economy of our size, that's very significant. And if we, I don't want to take too much time on this part, but the levels of debt are kind of following the pattern that you currently have here in the United States, increasing dramatically, almost double to the period when the house was in order physically, from the fiscal perspective. Debt to GDP ratio, the year I left government as Minister of Finance, the debt to GDP ratio was way below 50%, which is what the Maastricht Agreement kind of gives us as an ideal, to now above 60%, which is a very difficult situation. From investment grade, we were the first country after Chile. Chile was the first. After Chile, it was El Salvador, then Mexico. Several years later, Peru. Several years later, Colombia. El Salvador got the investment grade in 1998, 6 years after signing the peace agreement. So it is possible to revert a very bad tendency or a very bad situation and make a positive comeback. And I think we have it within our DNA to do that. I was giving you some data before in terms of expenditures. Well, where has that money gone? On one hand, it has gone to increase the public sector size. you know, you might think 20,000 is not that many people. Well, that's more than 10% or about 10% of the public sector. So most of the money has gone to hire people in the public sector. There are some 500 new unions in the country. So instead of growing jobs in the private sector, jobs are being created somewhere else that is not productive. But more importantly, if that 11% increment per year that has taken place lately in taxes was to go some in a magic way towards the poorest of the poor, then one could say, well, you know, it is helping the poorest of the poor. Well, that is not the case. The bottom 20% of the population is getting zero from all of those subsidies that are currently being given and have been given for the last 8 or 10 years in a very significant way. So that's, in my view, regrettably, because the monies are not going to where it is really needed. And finally, in terms of poverty, we are poorer than we were a few years ago. So you are collecting more. You are getting $500 to $800 million from the government of Venezuela through ALBA, yet we have more poor people than before. Today, like during the armed invasion, Cuba, through Venezuela and others, like some Russians and Iranians, are very much interested in getting back what they were not able to get 20 years ago. Using ALBA, which is spending or has right now some $500 to $800 million from a government to a political party to several businesses of the municipalities of the FMLN. And for you to have a magnitude here, an order of magnitude here, an election in El Salvador is won with $60 million. The FMLN has from the Venezuelan government some 10 times that amount of money to do a lot of things now. Now, there is a very different, there is an additional difference between what we had during the armed invasion and today. Today we also have, according to the UCA, the Catholic University and other bodies, about 45,000 members of gangs and less than 25,000 members of the police or the military. So there is a big disparity there. And according to a study that was done by the World Bank in about 5 or 6 years ago, there is about $7 billion worth of drugs that pass through Central America. And the budget of all of the security entities in Central America is less than $500 million. So $7 billion versus $0.5 billion for security. Now, Washington. What has been the role of Washington? And what should be the posture of Washington, in my humble opinion? Well, the role has been, and I'm talking about the last few years, from passive to permissive and indifferent. And it should be actually a partner in security and growth. The candidate of the FMLN, Sánchez Serén, has come to the United States several times, so the FMLN knows that the U.S. is needed. The MCC is being challenged due to the poor performance of a government that is looking for an alibi to cover its incompetence. Where was El Salvador when the MCC started, and where is El Salvador today? And the facts and numbers speak by themselves. So a policy decision that can influence the election is currently at play. The elections will take place on February the 2nd of next year. As was mentioned earlier, there is a tie today between the candidate of ARENA, Norman Quijano, and the candidate of the FMLN, Salvador Sánchez Serén, at about 30% each, and SACA in a distant 12%. There is likely to be a second round in March of next year, and in my opinion, if there is no fraud, I think Quijano has a chance to win. Now, governing will not be easy. There is a big fiscal deficit. The debt is very high, and the credibility is again at levels that we haven't seen since the years of the war. The institutions are weak and captured. We have had big debates with the Supreme Court and others that have been attempted to be taken, and some have been taken by the political parties, drugs and gangs that have received a license to operate, literally, will continue to be present, and crony capitalism. We also have that. The platforms of the candidates, of the three main candidates, are very similar, and that shouldn't be a surprise. They are very similar because they are reading the same polls. I think the difference can be found in how each of them is proposing to address the needs of the Salvadorians, and then the teams that they are going to put together to actually deliver on such promises. On the Arena side, you can summarize their program as regaining the path towards prosperity. In their Plan País, they are talking about education, equal access to opportunities, security, job creation, a free, democratic, integrated country. And the way they are proposing to do it is similar to what we saw once before, fiscal stability, building trust and confidence, private sector-led growth, and combating corruption. The FMLN, their government program can be summarized as government-led growth. Their government plan puts a lot of emphasis on small and medium-sized enterprises, supporting them, puts emphasis on a relationship with Petrocaribe, on investing in health and in education, and in security as well. They are proposing to raise the salaries of police, doctors, and teachers. And how they are proposing to do this? Through subsidies, which I have shown what happened with them, to continuing this social warfare and political distance, bringing doctors and teachers from Cuba, which we have seen in other places in the neighborhood, and relying on Venezuelan money, which I don't think is going, there is much available and is with strings attached. The SACA platform, I will just summarize it in one line. I think his policy is keep me out of jail, keep my money policy. Now, all of the three candidates have challenges and opportunities for each of them. In the case of Quijano, he has to connect with people and persuade leaders that his job as mayor can transcend to the presidency and that he would be able to have a good team next to him. Sánchez Serén has to deliver to Cuba their political interest in the region, and he already has about 1 million voters in his pocket. In the case of SACA, he needs to force the second round to be a kingmaker. His Alemán Arena Pact, like the one in Nicaragua, seems to be working for him. Now, the future. And I started by saying that it's not comfortable to share some of the facts and opinions when the situation of the country, of my country, is not the best. But I think we have shown historically that we can come back again. We can redo things and find again the path to prosperity independently. This is very important, independently of the political parties. There were another 12 people at the same time I joined government for three presidents that did not belong to any political party. And the last president I worked for in the 48 members of cabinet had only 2 members of a political party. The other 40 plus members, including myself, did not belong to any political party. So there is some raw material in there that can be used. So going forward, Salvadorians have been able to overcome the most adverse conditions once before. 70 years of military ruling, an armed invasion that killed a significant number of our population and forced about 22% of our population to migrate, polarized society, earthquakes every 14 years, tropical storms every year. And I want to think that what we are going through is a 10-year bump, but we are not doomed nor dead. We are a resilient society that has adapted and learned from history. It is in our DNA to be better, to work hard, and to take destiny into our own hands. I think that we will be able to change the shameful and destructive populism and socialism of the 21st century again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that presentation, that very comprehensive presentation. I want to sort of emphasize or focus on the different scenarios going forward. I think you touched on the what if generally at the end, but I was hoping for the broader audience, it was easy 20 years ago to talk about why El Salvador was important to the United States and the region. I still think there's a case today. But I think that you would be best to articulate those things, and I just want to sort of get your sense with the three candidates. How would you see things going forward? It seems like it's more likely, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it's more likely that Sánchez Serén and Quijano, or one of the two, would win the presidency. If Mr. Serén wins or Mr. Quijano wins, how different is that? What should we be expecting? And what's the role of Saca, period? It seems unlikely that he'll win, but we never know. So could you play out the different scenarios going forward?
As I mentioned, I think that there is very likely to be a second round between most likely Arena and the FMLN, mm-hmm. which has been kind of the pattern in the last, since 1989 or so, since the FMLN became a political party. I think that is the scenario, the most likely scenario, but as you suggest, the presence of former President Saca creates a special situation in the sense that it can divide the vote of the right, and some argue that about 75% of those supporting him will support in a second round Arena, and 25% will support the FMLN. Who knows? Our system is not one that someone will just come and say, I give my votes to such and such. It will have to be the people actually coming and voting. I think the consequences of one candidate of the other, if we stay with the scenario of the FMLN or Arena, I think that to an extent, Arena can provide a little bit of a better environment in terms of investments that can be created in the country, and therefore job creation primarily from the private sector can exist. And therefore, if the economy somehow revamps, I am not sure if it's going to be able to go back to the 4% average, but let's say to 2.5% or 3%, and as more jobs are created in the country, well, one net effect is that there is less migration mm-hmm. to the United States. Another effect, if you have a policy different than the one the FMLN has put forward in terms of literally been sitting with the gang members and negotiating certain counties within the country where they can navigate freely, and instead of that you have a stronger judicial system and a stronger police, which I think the Arena Party is more likely to go in that direction, then you're going to have less crime, less drugs, and less of the other challenges that come through Central America, including El Salvador, and that also Honduras and Guatemala are facing significantly. The most likely scenario has those two most significant impacts to the United States: migration and a higher level of insecurity. And if the scenario that is currently existing in Venezuela, where you have influence from countries that have not been in the area before, like Iran, because the Russians were in Central America through Cuba and Nicaragua before, or at least sending weapons, that will open up another geopolitical challenge for the United States in that scenario.
Mm-hmm. And you know that there's upcoming elections coming up in Honduras. Is there any effect of the outcome in Honduras? Would that have an outcome, or is there any implied outcome of the result in El Salvador?
Yeah, last October I was with a group of friends from Honduras, and I asked them, you know, what were the statistics or what were the polls saying? And they say, oh, you know, don't worry about Xiomara, she's only 2% in the polls. Well, she has been able to even pass for at least a period of time the candidate Juan Orlando Arevalo of one of the parties. And I think whatever happens in Honduras in a couple of weeks could impact El Salvador either positively or negatively. If the Zelaya-Xiomara party wins, then that tells that what ALBA is doing is actually working out for them, and I think they will be more empowered and will also have a stronger message to deliver within El Salvador. If they were to fail, then they still have money, enough money, to do harm, at least for the short term, in my view, all the way towards the election. I don't know if in the long term, I don't think in the long term Venezuela will be in a position of continuing to give the amounts of money that is given. But again, our economies are so small that $500 million is the rounding off error for a country like Venezuela. And yet with that, you can do a lot of damage in a country like El Salvador.
I'm going to open it up. I have a lot more questions, but I have to be unselfish. So I'm going to open it up to questions. I'm trying to get as many of you. Please identify yourselves and ask your question. Why don't I start over here? If we could get a microphone right over here, please.
Thank you very much.
Is that on?
Thank you very much, and thank you, Doctor, for a very good presentation. I'm John Gizzi with Newsmax, and my question is twofold. First, the presidents of Guatemala and Mexico, among others, have urged an end to the war on drugs within the hemisphere and have called on President Obama to end the program, say it's not working. What would be the position of the respective political parties on this? And my other question, and I guess this is for some of us here who are not as young as they used to be, some of us remember when José Napoleón Duarte and Major Dobasson were the major contenders, the players in Salvadoran politics. And I understand that both of their sons went on to hold office afterward. Do the names and families of Duarte, Napoleon Duarte, and Dobasson still resonate and play a role in politics there?
We go one by one, or we take a couple? Okay, so I'll start with the second question. Both names continue to resonate, Duarte and Dobasson. Perhaps, or certainly not as much as several years ago. The son of Mayor Dobasson is a member of Congress, and the son of President, one of the sons of President Duarte, is the Minister of Tourism in El Salvador. I think very highly of both of them as individuals, but I don't see them, if that was part of your question, I don't see them playing a significant bigger political role, at least in the short term. In terms of the war on drugs and the position that Guatemala and Mexico have expressed, including at the World Economic Forum last January, I was there and Moises Naim was moderating the panel. You will have to ask the political parties, but in my view, none of the political parties will probably think in terms of legalizing drugs or going in the same direction as those proposals that we have heard from Guatemala and Mexico. But who knows? I mean, at the end of the day, things can happen, but that is not something that is being discussed. It's not part of the platforms of any of the political parties. And I think that if they were to make a proposal of legalizing drugs, the political party that makes that proposal, I think, will drop 10 points.
Why don't we go over here? I think you have a microphone in front of you. Yeah. You have a microphone in front of you? Yeah, just turn it on. Yeah, great.
Hello. Thank you, Doctor, for a very interesting perspective. My name is Sam Green. I work at National Defense University and the National Defense College of Abu Dhabi. I'll ask two questions that are directly focused on the security sector. So you suggest that an ARENA government will do a better job at reducing drug crime and violence. I'm wondering, given that Arena didn't have a great record on that when it was in government, what would be different about the Quijano government? And then the second question is, you mentioned Iran, and what is your evidence, or on what basis do you suggest that there might be Iranian influence in an FMLN government? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, when I made a reference of countries like Iran and Russia, I did it because they are in Nicaragua, they are certainly in Venezuela, and you know there is a direct flight from Tehran to Caracas, which I don't know what kind of business is there, but given the influence of Venezuela or the government of Venezuela in some of the Central American countries today with the magnitude of money that I'm explaining to you, I submit to you that there are other interests in addition to some kind of simply political relationship with some of these countries that have nothing to do with the reality of our own country. Now, if you ask me, do I have a picture of an Iranian in there? I don't, but I'm sure there have been some contacts in Central America, and I will let that to for others who might have more information to address it. In terms of the security proposals, I show some indicators in terms of governance, the fight against corruption, and institution, the capacity of the institution. There is an indicator that I happen to like a lot is the World Governance Indicators. They used to be produced by Danny Kaufman when he was at the World Bank. They are now being produced. He continues to produce them for another entity. And that measures voice and accountability, the rule of law. It measures the strength of the judicial system. It measures a lot of variables that are very important. And in all of those indicators, we have significantly reduced from what we had before. So one point of reference is that in the past, there has been much more respect, never perfect, but much more respect to the independence of the different institutions, especially the Supreme Court, which as of today is really the only, and I'm talking about this, the constitutional court of the Supreme Court, is the one that has been a little bit more independent to the political parties, and they are being constantly being attacked. And so if you want to combat successfully crime, you have to let those institutions be as independent as they can be. And so there is a track record that shows that for 15 or 20 years between 1989 and 2004, there was an improvement in the strength of the institutions. I think that that is something that we, I think, could expect much better than the track record that we have had in the last 10 years, where the curve has gone in the opposite direction. At the same time, as I also mentioned, I don't think you will see a country like the United States, so you say you are studying in Abu Dhabi, a country like the Emirates, sitting down with criminals and negotiating a truce and actually selecting parts of the country where they cannot be touched. That's what we have right now with the gangs. And, okay, well, you wanted to try that. Well, the effect hasn't been positive at all. So criminals ought to be in jail, and the free people should be outside and not the other way around. Right now, the innocents have to be, you know, protecting themselves inside their house, and the criminals are in 7 or 9 places where they can freely do whatever they want. So I think that given the track record of what we have seen for the two major parties, I think that Arena has a better proposal on that front. Would any of them fix the problem? I don't think that that's doable in the short period of time, because when you have $7 billion of drugs passing through Central America against $500 million for all of the Central American countries in terms of security, there is a disproportion there, so some kind of help needs to be put in place.
Go here with Stephen.
You have to hit the button. And let's try the microphone.
Stephen Donahue from McLarty Associates. Thank you very much. El Salvador's got a hole to dig itself out of, And it's not clear to me, and maybe because I've lost track of the election cycle, even if Dr. Quijano were elected for Morena, how he would be able to get the support in the National Assembly to be able to accomplish any of these things. The FMLN has become certainly entrenched in the bureaucracy and perhaps in the political process. What does he do, how does he do it to actually move out of this if he can get elected?
Yeah, that's a very good point. We have the elections, the presidential elections are every 5 years, and the elections of mayors and members of Congress is every 3 years. So there have been, actually when I was in government, in one of those 5 year terms, we got three elections in the 5 years, one presidential and two for Congress and mayors. So the year after, to 2015, we have the elections of Congress and of mayors. And I think that what we had last year where the FMLN lost some seats and Arena and other parties won more seats show a little bit of the kind of the balance of powers that Salvadorians intrinsically select. And so when someone, a political party is in the executive branch, you would expect the opposition to have one or two more members of Congress in parliament. The 12 years that I was in government, the last 8 years, the FMLN was the majority party in Congress. So I think both parties have learned to deal with the opposition party leading or having more votes in Congress. There have been two very concrete efforts that at least two of the candidates, Quijano and I think Saca, I don't think Sanchez Cerén actually signing, but there was a proposal made by several organizations from civil society for a vision of the country. And I might be wrong on this one. I think all of them might have signed on it. So there are some points of convergence that hopefully they will respect once in power. They just approved the budget with a majority of vote. I wish that would have happened when I was a Minister of Finance for three consecutive years. We didn't get enough votes to have a budget approved, which is, you know, sounds similar to what's going on here in the United States. And so the parties, all of them, voted for the budget because they all expect to be in power next year and use that budget. So I think that whomever comes to the presidency is going to have the challenges that I described before, plus the fact that most likely the opposite party will have control of Congress.
You know, on the issue of elections, you know, whichever way you look at it, it seems that this is going to be a tight election. Is there a concern regarding fraud? Is there a concern regarding the need for international observation? What's the discussion that's going on in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. There is concern. And again, going back to your previous question of Honduras, a lot of people are paying a lot of attention of what happens there also because of that, in the sense that an election can be lost on the D-Day. In the case of El Salvador, the elections are still, you vote on a piece of paper, and there is one representative of each political party sitting in the table that counts the votes. And if you look at it, you have the FMLN, Arena, and all of the other parties that are supporting Saca under the Unidad flag. So a lot of things can happen on the D-Day, all the way from what happened in the previous election, that public transportation is somehow impaired or facilitated just from one side or to the other, or that when you are on the table, someone scratches the voting ballot and says, oh, this one is dismissed. So these risks are there, and therefore it's very important for organizations like Democratic Party Organization or the IRI and others who usually come, except that this time I wish there were hundreds and not only 50 or 100, but, you know, there are 2,500 voting polls out of the 5,000, if I'm not mistaken, that are very critical in the sense of the amount of people that go to vote to those polls. And it would be great if at least those were to be observed much better. I also know that there is a group of young people in El Salvador that is called the Group of 300. I think there are more than 300 young people in that group. They are bringing people from Sumate, from Venezuela, to share with them the experiences they have had to hopefully control or oversee much better what happens on the D-Day. So that is a big concern for many people.
Okay. I'm gonna, the gentleman back here with the silver tie.
Hi, Roberto Peña. I'm with the European Union delegation here in Washington. I wanted to ask you about dollarization and if you would consider doing anything differently today, given how it could potentially limit the ability of the current government to use monetary policy to address some of the economic issues you flagged earlier?
That's a very good question, Roberto. And as you know, the macroeconomy of any country is supported by two pillars, the monetary policy and the fiscal policy. In the case of El Salvador, we decided to secure and have as much predictability as possible on the monetary policy and just use or work with the fiscal policy. Why? For several reasons. Number one, 80% of our exports are to the United States or to Central America in dollars. Most contracts in the economy are indexed to dollars or were indexed to dollars. We have 22% of our population living in the United States and sending, at that time, about 16% of the GDP of the economy in remittances to the country. And they were paying about 30% in because of the exchange rate, so that money was going somewhere else, about $450 million that could go to poor people. It was going to the intermediaries. So, and even though we were investment grade, we still had interest rates of about 27% when the interest rates around the world in dollars were about 5%. So with dollarization, we were able to reduce interest rates from about 25 to 27% to about 6.5%. That meant that people who could not afford a house at that time with $14 a month could buy a very humble house, get the loan not for 10 years but for 30 years, and that's why you could pay a very low amount. And so I think it has made sense. It has eliminated the possibility of politicians to do what is happening here, printing as much money as you can. Here, you have the means. In my country, we don't. So it is much better to be linked to the Federal Reserve Board of any states in the United States than our own to avoid the volatility of exchange rate that could exist in a situation like the one we are currently going through. So from the perspective of El Salvador, in my view, having an economy that is integrated to the strongest, so far, economy in the world makes sense. And if, just in case that was not enough, you have the case of a country like Ecuador, which is run by a government similar to ours, and they have maintained dollarization because they know that if you revert it, you're going to go back not only to 27% interest rates, but you're actually going to confiscate the pensions of the people because they're going to go to bed having 100 colones and are going to wake up having those 100 colones be worth 90 colones and not 100 if we went to go back to our currency.
The lady in the back.
Hi, to share questions. My name is Mirta Postuma. I work for the Due Process of Law Foundation. Regarding the numbers on competitiveness that you showed, my impression is that one of the most important problems that hinders a major development in that aspect is the corruption that has been so institutionalized under ARENA, co-opting the Comptroller General's Office, the Corte de Cuentas, and the Fiscalía, the Attorney General's Office, and something that has continued in this government of the FMLN. I was wondering if you think that elections can make a difference in that, or that the current political establishment on both parties will make a difference, and if you think that perhaps the elections in 2015 of a new parliamentary elections in which people can choose candidates rather than parties could make a difference. And my second question is, I don't know if you saw yesterday's news that Quijano has authorized a big deal with Alba Petróleos. I'm wondering if in that light or in that light of that news that he's dealing with Alba Petróleos as well, if that changes anything that you just said about that business and the parties.
Those are two very good questions. I don't know exactly about that particular deal of Quijano with Alba. If it is, I think it's a mistake. I don't have a problem in saying that, because I think you are risking a lot of things, including your sovereignty in the country. And in terms of whether candidate versus party can increase the participation of the people and have more independent bodies, I think yes. That's what you have in many other countries, where you actually vote for the person and not necessarily for a political party. To be honest, I don't think any of the political parties are perfect for that matter. I put again the numbers there, because all of these numbers have sources: the World Bank, the UN, the World Governance Indicators, etc. They show that there has been a decay, a deceleration, or a decrease in how the independence of these institutions has been compromised in terms of the capturing. You know, the latest example was last year, when the Constitution clearly states that you cannot be member of a political party to be the president of the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court president was a member of not only a member, but the legal representative of Alba in El Salvador, and so he has been destituted. So the court is at least working. And the same should happen if it is from ARENA or PCN or any of the other political party, because that independence is very important to exist. So was it perfect before? No. But looking at what credible organizations are saying in terms of their rankings and ratings, I think we are a little bit worse off than we were before in all of those institutions.
Roger.
Does this work?
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss the dynamics in El Salvador, but do have implications for our country. And, you know, you referenced, for example, the Alemán Pact in 1994 in Nicaragua, being replicated in a sense with what SACA is doing in El Salvador today, apparently. A major difference being that Nicaragua wasn't, in Central America more generally, wasn't overwhelmed with narco-trafficking the way it is today. And so when you have a pact that is to keep primarily one person out of jail, you have to wonder whether it's going to be a law and order for everyone else, or whether it's going to create a permissive environment for the narco-traffickers in El Salvador and beyond, and that's playing out in Honduras as well. But the lady with the Due Process Center and you, as a matter of fact, alluded to the fact that there has been sort of you mentioned the degradation and the separation of powers, I think, or the institutionality, and you said over the last 10 years, which would lump SACA in. From what I've heard anecdotally and from folks in El Salvador, in point of fact, this began even while SACA was in power. And those of us around the table here who worked in the U.S. government always perceived SACA as a friend of the United States. And so it sort of comes as a surprise, but I think we need to sort of recognize that maybe along the way, what we've been saying privately about corruption by Saka is very much in play, and that he's playing this role to the detriment of the institutions in the country, and creating a permissive environment, perhaps, for narco-trafficking. Is there some sense in El Salvador, among Salvadoran voters, for example, that this may be playing out, or are his motives not questioned in that way?
Well, it is vox populi in the country that that, you know, what has been in the news lately is all the way from some Spanish newspapers and one from Florida, and even in El Salvador, about the period of former President Saka. That's in a lot of people's mind in terms of, and by the way, to the question of the lady before, she was from the Arena Party, so she's right when she mentions that both parties have had their share of fault in what is taking place. The only difference is that at that time, in the case of your question, Saka was actually the president of the country and the president of the party, so he had full control on that sense. And, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts even more. So that is part of the concern that especially the middle class has in terms of how the previous government was and how the relationship with the current government is. And that's why I think there is a ceiling of about 12% today of people supporting him.
I'm auto right.
Can you?
It's on.
I think it's working now. Is it working?
I think
he just didn't press it correctly.
Okay.
Now that he's gone, we can say that. Otto Reich from Otto Reich Associates. You mentioned in your presentation briefly the Millennium Challenge Corporation. Seems to be stuck, and yet the government of El Salvador is announcing that it's going forward. What is the status, and what's the significance? Why is it important?
Yeah. The MCC is very important, and it's not important because of the money per se, but because of the matrix that are used to actually determine to which country to provide support. I was invited 16, I was a minister of finance then. Rose Likens was the ambassador of the U.S. in El Salvador when the criteria for the MCC were being developed. And I thought that it was a good idea how the MCC was going to work, not necessarily for the amount of money, because to be honest, the debate here or the amount for $500 million is very helpful, is more than welcome, is for a 4 or 5 years period. But I used to raise $3 billion going to the markets when we were investment grade and didn't have to rely on anybody. Actually, I cut off all of the aid to El Salvador, except when we had the earthquakes in 2001, because it was more of a trouble receiving aid than actually producing and being accountable ourselves. And we never stopped making any payments of our debt. So El Salvador is a very responsible country, and I tend to believe that there is no excuse not to be like that again. So the MCC is important. We are very grateful to the people of the United States who's given us their taxes to come to our country. But the most important part are the matrix. And what is happening right now, and the reason I mentioned the trips of Sanchez Seren, is that even though at a point in time he was in Paris burning the U.S. flag after 9/11, he knows that the United States is a very important partner. 22% of our population is here. So you cannot burn the flag on one hand and put the hand on the other to get $400 or $500 million. I think that money is very important. Hopefully it will be ratified and approved, and hopefully it will be used appropriately for the good of the country. But let's make no mistake, when we started, in terms of the matrix of the MCC, we were here we are now somewhere here. So we owe it to the people who are making these decisions to get back to those matrix that are actually more like what El Salvador has been able to do.
John.
Dr. Daou, thank you for your presentation. My name is John Maestro. I'm a retired U.S. Foreign Service officer. You are in a position, as are many of us who have been in government, to try to look to the future, to try to figure out scenarios. Could I ask you to speculate on the most hopeful outcome you see for your country, and as well, the worst case scenario you see, with an election coming up in Central America, which will be observed internationally, I presume, with an election system that isn't 100%, but it's not terrible either. But how do you see things, you know, in February? Well, if it goes to a runoff, and there'll be a new government, and what would be the best case, what would be the worst?
Well, the base case scenario is one where there are free and transparent elections, and the people can actually express who they want them to represent them. If that is the case, I tend to believe, as I said before, that Norman Quijano has a good chance of winning. I think that it will be a very close call if the FMLN was to win, and the scenario of an FMLN victory, in my view, is the worst that we can have for one simple reason. What we have seen is not very encouraging in terms of their performance. Their reliance on Venezuela, in addition to be short-term, unsustainable, and linked to a lot of conditionality, is not the way to run a country. You know, a country that is successful like Chile, Ireland, New Zealand, Australia, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and even China have done it because they have economic and political freedom. So the best scenario possible is one with free and transparent elections, where the candidate that is elected actually puts the fiscal house in order, addresses the security concern head on, and works with the United States as a partner and not asking for aid or assistentialism. And I think that that scenario, we have seen it before with ARENA. And I want to say something. I don't support everything that ARENA has done in the past, certainly not during the SACA period. But what was done right after the war was very much produced some very good results in many areas. There were gaps and errors, but what we have seen of the FMLN in power is very dramatic. So the worst scenario will be that one, augmented or even worse if something similar like that were to happen in Honduras. So if you were to have in Honduras and in El Salvador, two parties alike governing, I think that will be very bad. On the other hand, if you were to have parties on the center right, I think more positive things can come out of that.
Okay, I'm going to take two more questions and then we're going to wrap up. Why don't we go here with the first woman here with the blouse, and then we'll finish up.
Thank you. Jessie Mejia. I am with the Governor's Office in Maryland. I've been hearing you speak a lot about being worried about sovereignty in El Salvador, and both from Caracas or I mean, you've mentioned Iran and such other things. My question has to do with a article that was published in a Salvadorian newspaper just this past recent week, I think, about members of the ARENA party lobbying here in D.C. to disqualify both the Unidad candidate and the FMLN candidate. What are your thoughts on that and the actual letters that were produced for Secretary Kerry to intervene?
My view on that is that every party has the right to reach out to their constituencies or people they feel close to inform, to get support, to get acquainted with. I mentioned the fact that the candidate of the FMLN has been frequently in the United States, in New York and in other places, so have been the candidate for the vice presidency, and so have been ARENA. So this is in every election, this has happened. That shows how much the candidates think of the relationship, of the importance of the relationship with the United States. Whether they like it or not, and I happen to like it, the United States is our big brother. We have to have a strong relationship with the United States for obvious reasons. And therefore, I am not surprised of any of the political parties reaching out to members of Congress and the Senate to tell their story. I mean, is their right, is their possibility, whatever the senators or the congressmen decide to do, it's also in their own, you know, it's their own decision.
And I would remind you that this happens with countries all over the world. El Salvador is not an exception by any means. Ma'am.
Ирина Акимушкина, консультант ООН.
Can we try the handheld, because I think that we're getting some interference here.
Thank you. Ирина Акимушкина, консультант ООН political and social issues for development agencies.
Can we move the microphone out of the way? Just move the microphone out of the way.
No, I just don't know
what's happening with that.
Dr. Dabao, thank you for your presentation. My question probably is not related to elections, but some way it's related. El Salvador is middle-income country, and there was debate among between international organization. As soon country reaches the level of middle-income country, it loses support, aid, benefits from development agencies. I would like to know your opinion in case of Salvador, El Salvador. Do you think, as managing director of the World Bank and finance minister, can you
Yeah, that was a big debate during the years I was at the bank in terms of the availability of resources for fragile states, for low-income countries versus middle-income countries. And I think that it is important to continue to work with middle-income countries for one very simple reason. On one hand, there is always a risk of middle-income countries to fall behind or the others to go faster, and therefore you need to be prepared. Then you have some countries like Greece, Spain, Portugal, and a few other European countries that have shown that at times you still need to have organizations like the IMF and others to come and be present and help. Having said that, in terms of aid, I would put most of the aid towards the least developed countries, especially fragile states, and invest more on the public policy side with middle-income countries so that they can enable much better the environment for the private sector to invest and therefore to have the economy be more closely linked to private sector, less growth than otherwise. Now, that shouldn't be interpreted as do not bring private sector investment to least developed countries. I'm just saying that because of the risk involved in fragile states or in low-income countries, if you have a fixed pie of resources, I would put more resources towards them than towards middle-income countries, but I will not stop a relationship with middle-income countries, because as I said before, some of them can fall back, and so it's better to keep helping them until they make it than if they fall back, because then it becomes much more expensive. In our case, I don't know, it took us before 15, 18 years to do significant progress, although in the first 6 we were able to make a big jump. It's probably going to take us 5 to 10 years to get back on track, provided that the internal conditions are in the right direction and that the external conditions in terms of the prices of food, fuel, and the financial situation of the world doesn't get worse.
One last question, and yeah, we're going to wrap up.
My name is Helen Hobbs. I have a question on, let's take it 89 or 91, or 92 when the peace accords were signed, to now. What was the greatest period of privatization? When did privatization take place most?
Yeah, it took place between 1995 and 2000. That was the time when competition was brought in. For most of the public services where competition could be provided, for example, on telecommunications, on electricity, on power generation, and also on the administration of the pension funds. So that's the time when telephone calls that used to cost $2.50 came down to 7 cents, and when at that time we used to have 11 million of minutes of calls from the United States or from El Salvador to the United States. So that was a big benefit. Now, privatization in itself, as many of you know, is not an end. It's a means to actually create a more competitive economy, provided that you privatize in competition. Because if you go from a public monopoly to a private monopoly, that's even worse, because the private monopoly is more efficient and can charge more to the people. So it has to be in competition, which was a big difference. And actually, only El Salvador and Chile did the reforms in that way at that time. All of the other countries went from a public monopoly to a private monopoly, and that was very perverse. And you saw that in Argentina, you saw that in Brazil, you saw that in Mexico, and even today, some sectors like telecommunication remain divided between one or two operators. In El Salvador, 21,000 square kilometers, 6 million people. We have 5 mobile operators, 2 fixed line operators. So it's a very competitive market in that sense.
There's one gentleman in the back who's giving me a very ugly look if I don't pick on him. And I think I'm going to let him, if you're okay with it.
Of course.
This is the last question. And I would ask you to please come up to the microphone, because we're having these technical problems. And if you want to be heard, all right. If you just press the button there you go.
Juan Jose, I would like to ask you 2 quick questions. One, if you have any evidence of the accusations regarding the burning of the flag of the United States by Salvador Sanchez Cerén. Okay. I have heard this argument and this gossip. I want to call it a lie, but let's say that it's very close to that, since I would like to see some evidence regarding that, because you dropped the same argument, an idea, a few minutes ago. The second is that I would like to see if you can comment on the investigation the IRS is actually doing on the former president, Francisco Flores. Thank you.
Francisco Flores. And what was, could you please identify yourself? I'm sorry, sir.
My name is Salvador Cortez, actually. I'm Salvadorian, and if you want to link me to GW, I'm a faculty there as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Cortez. On the second question first, no, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows investigations of the IRS, but you can check with them. And on the first part, I'm referring to articles that have been published in respectable newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and others that have made a reference to the burning of the flag. I was in El Salvador when that march took place, and I saw them in the march, whether he lighted the fire or not, the match. I cannot say I saw that, but I saw the burning of the flag, and I saw all of the leaders of the FMLN in the front of that march. So it's visual evidence of my part.
OK.
Okay, well, I want to thank you all for coming. It's gone over, but Juan Jose, you've been very generous with your time. Would you please join me in a round of applause?